When I think back, Cliff, about that decision, I often wonder how I did it myself. We'd actually won the championship, and we started the season, a new season, and wasn't doing too well. Now, some of the boys were going over the top, but it was a tremendous thing to say, all right, now I must actually take a number of these players out, put young ones in. But over the time, I'd had the opportunity of trying. We'd started a youth system and from the start, and it was there, and you could see players of caliber there, but they were still very young. And it got to the stage, I started thinking myself, will I do it, will I not? Well, perhaps I was helped. We played a friendly game in Kilmarnock in Scotland on the Wednesday, following us winning against Aston Villa. 1-0, but I was not satisfied. I wasn't happy about it. And we played this match, and I put a lot of these young boys in, and we won 4-0. And I remember the following day, walking along the golf course, and these things were turning over my mind, and I said to myself, well, they won 4-0, but what was the strength of the 4-0 win? And this went on for a couple of days. Will I put them in? Will I not? And all of a sudden I said, right, I'm going to put them all in. And it was at Huddersfield the following Saturday, and I think we had Alan Chilton for experience at the back, Jack Rowley to hold them together, and I think Stan Pearson's all along. The rest of all the dumping.
These are three of the championship side, and all the eight were new
boys. That's right. Yeah. So it was a big decision, but sometimes you've got to face these things. As I say, it worked out the right way.
You've made.
Hello, dear Reds, and it's Red News Podcast 34. And we're just paying a little tribute to the Babes. Because obviously our thoughts are turning this week to those and those terrible events in Munich. And I'm just reading through Matt Busby's My Story. And the first edition was published in 1957. And he ends it by writing, with youth teams talented enough to make a 5-year monopoly of the FA National Youth Cup competition, there is no reason why Manchester United should not remain in the forefront of English and European soccer for at least another 10 years. I hope to be at Old Trafford to see it, because I believe I mentioned before, this is the finest club in the world. Just events betrayed that, and he did an update just a year later, and he put, since I wrote my book, the whole world seems to have fallen about my ears. Looking back now on some of my confident predictions concerning the future of Manchester United, I realise that the one factor for which I did not legislate was the failure of an aeroplane to leave the ground on takeoff. At the moment, I do not feel inclined to discuss what happened at the airport, because even now, 6 months after, the recollections bring so much grief. The fact which must be faced, though, is the loss of many of my great footballers and my finest friends. I'm quite serious when I say that on many mornings I wake up believing that all those who perished are still alive. Then follows the realisation that this cannot be. It is the mood of reality that I survey the future of my club. Indeed, the greatest tribute I can pay to the present team is to assure them that no club in Britain could have survived such a disaster and still won so many vitally important matches in its aftermath. Of one thing, however, I am convinced: it took a long time to build the championship-winning United team. It is going to take a long time to build the new United, but it shall be built, regardless of the effort involved. You can't imagine what Sir Matt must have gone through, and that's my theme as a United fan who wasn't alive then. I just can't imagine. It's unfathomable, and it is testament to everyone: Jimmy Murphy, the club, every single person involved in the rebirth, that we managed 10 years later to win the European Cup. And Bill Fawkes wrote, I had come the whole way with the boss, trying to make Manchester United the champions of Europe. I thought the destruction of our team at Munich would have been the end of it, but he patiently put together another side. I'm proud to have been part of it. And for those of us who lost our friends coming home from a European Cup tie in 1958, our victory seemed the right tribute to their memory. So Matt talked in the aftermath of 58 about getting to Wembley, an incredible achievement that year alone. And he wrote, there need be no recriminations about the performance of Manchester United that day. Surely their greatest performance was in reaching Wembley, at all in view of the circumstances. Could any other club have done as much as we did? There were many victims to Munich. The people, the players, the journalists, the players who were never able to play again. Bobby Charlton was convinced that we would have won the European Cup with that side. He wrote, "In my heart, I'm convinced that the old United side would have done it the year of Munich." And who were the players then? These babes. I talked later about Duncan Edwards with Tom Clare. And we also have a tribute by Pete Martin. Jimmy Murphy wrote about some of the players affected. Roger Byrne, a superbly built athlete who had already won a league championship medal as a winger before he became a regular left-back and captain. As a partner, we found a miner from St Helens named Bill Fawkes, who was destined to become one of the greatest club men of all time. Fawkes had never pretended to be a pretty player with delicate ball control, but over the years he has been a model of consistency and his record is almost unbelievable. He became one of the hardest and toughest full right-backs in the game. Eddie Coleman was a natural. There was never any doubt which club he would join. From boyhood, he had been a Manchester United fan. Eddie was an original. No matter how I search my memory, I cannot recall another player with his particular flair or personality or that cheeky waggle of the hips as he swept past opponents. In modern football, it shrieks for the personality player. Little Eddie would have shone like the North Star. The press took him to their hearts and dubbed him Swivel Hips, the player with a wiggle like Marilyn Monroe. Harry Gregg summed it up. When Eddie waggled his hips, he mesmerised me so much he had me diving the wrong way, and I swear he made the stanchions in the grandstand sway with him. I used to say to him, "Eddie, son, if only you would learn to shoot like Duncan Edwards, you would get 20 goals a season." The wee fella grinned back, "Maybe Jimmy, but I'm also a murderous finisher from 2 yards. The years cannot dim my memories of him, and now is the time to state what a wonderful player he was. There was a tough Yorkshire boy, Mark Jones, who at one time had ambitions to be a professional boxer until soccer claimed him. Mark was a strong, fearless, hard-tackling, orthodox stopper centre-half. Another great player, Liam Whelan, who came to us from Home Farm, the Dublin junior side, which also produced Johnny Carey. He had the same almost leisurely style that Carey had. He also had the same immaculate control of the ball. Even when it was hammered at him, he could pull it down as though it was attached to his feet by string. Here was a player who grew on you. The more you studied his play, a boy who was a fantastic manipulator of the ball, as he was to prove in a snowstorm in Bilbao in January 1957. There are goals which stay imprinted on the mind for all time, and this was one of them. And on Duncan Edwards. In the case of Duncan Edwards, his transition from youth and junior football into the league side was relatively easy because, even as a schoolboy, he had the temperament of a mature player. From the first time I saw him play as a boy of 14, Duncan Edwards looked like and played with the assurance of a man, with legs like tree trunks, a deep and powerful chest, and an unforgettable zest for the game. He started playing football with his cousin Dennis Stevens, who was later to earn football fame himself as a player with Bolton and Everton. Joe Armstrong, Bert Walley and myself kept close watching his progress, and naturally Matt had made it clear we must do everything in our power to try and persuade Duncan Edwards that if he wanted to be a professional footballer, then Manchester United was the only club for him. We were helped by the fact that Duncan himself, impressed by the stories he had read of Manchester United's first great team just after the war, was attracted by the idea of coming to a club which placed football skill and entertainment at the top of its priorities. In those days, every club in the country had an army of scouts scouring the junior football fields to try and spot a future star. This did not make things easy. When he knew Matt Busby wanted him, naturally Duncan Edwards was interested. And the fact that he eventually signed for United was due in no small measure to my good friend and an assistant, Bert Walley. Duncan played his first game for Manchester United at the age of 15 years and 285 days. In the next 5 years, this is what he achieved. He was the youngest footballer ever to play for England. He had won 19 full caps for his country by the time he was killed, which is 19 more than Bobby Charlton had at that time, and there was less than a two-year age gap between them. He had won two league championship medals. He captained English schoolboys, English under-23s, and with respect to Bobby Moore, there was only one man on the horizon to lead England after Billy White, and that man was Duncan Edwards. While he was playing for Manchester United in the league side, he was still eligible for our youth team. I could fill a book with stories about Duncan Edwards. I'm not letting my heart rule my head and speaking emotionally about a boy cruelly stuck down when he had not even touched the fringe of greatness. On and off the field, Duncan was an amazing fellow. He never smoked nor drank, and even as a boy, he was so professional in his approach to the game. He was an shining example to all youngsters. Into 5 years, he crammed a lifetime of football experience. I described Duncan the first time I saw him as the greatest thing on 2 feet. When he died, I still thought that. There seemed no end to the savagery of Munich. Like everyone in football, I mourned the loss of Duncan Edwards, and even now I still think it was perhaps the biggest loss to English football. I'm quite sure that England with Roger Byrne, Tommy Taylor, and certainly with Duncan, they could have won the 1958 World Cup. But all this is now conjecture and speculation. What I do know now is that when managers and coaches and trainers and scouts and all those in the vast army of professional footballers who try to keep their wheels turning get together for a chat about old times and old players and the state of the game, now there is always one name which crops up. Duncan Edwards, the real professional. They will tell you that there has never been anyone quite like him, and who am I to disagree with the opinion? Indeed, when I hear Cassius Clay, otherwise known as Muhammad Ali, proclaimed to the world via television and radio, "I am the greatest," I have to smile, you see. The greatest of them all was an English footballer named Duncan Edwards, and he died following an air crash in a Munich hospital at the age of 21.
Do it once in a case of a Duncan Edwards, and say, "There it is, and there it is," and there's nothing more you can say except he's going to do it.
He'll be one of the greatest footballers the world's ever seen.
But
Jimmy Murphy continued in Matt United and me writing. To the generations which have grown up since then, these may just be names, but to me they were Matt's boys. My boys. I'd seen them come to Old Trafford as part of Matt Busby's master plan to build the greatest side in Europe, and they were gone. Seven of the greatest players ever assembled in one club wiped out, and the greatest of them all, Duncan Edwards, fighting for his life. I was like a man living through a nightmare waiting to wake up. I locked the door, put my head on the desk and wept like a child when I heard. Only last Monday I'd waved cheerio to them. "See you Thursday, lads. See you do a good job." They did. They'd won through to the semi-final of the European Cup. Now they were gone, at the very moment when they had the world of soccer at their feet. Like everyone else close to the biggest tragedy ever to hit a football club, I was too numb to take in the awful grief and savage heartbreak. Agony piled on agony as the hours ticked remorselessly on. There was nothing to lift the blanket of despair.
Duncan Edwards, you had Eddie Coleman and so on, all these great players. And then came this terrible Munich tragedy in which you lost almost the core of this young side. Do you remember now, looking back to those days you spent in that Munich hospital, exactly how you felt?
Yes, I do remember. It was a terrible, terrible experience. And I remember my feelings when I did come to a bit to sanity and realize the whole situation. And the last thing I thought at the time would be that I'd ever be associated with football again. That was out. That was definitely out. It was a terrible mental time. Mentally, it was a terrible time. And I remember one day, the family, the daughter who stayed with me, Jane, my wife, and probably a few weeks when someone came in talking about football, and they'd known not to discuss anything at all at the time. And all of a sudden, Jane had said something about, "Look, this is your life, this is something you've got to do, you've got to face it, you've got it in your mind, and these boys probably would want you to go back," and all on their lines, and it started a little seed again, and I got this little bit of vodka, saying to herself, all right, yes, I think I'll try and go back. And as the days progressed, I said, yes, I'm going back.
Manchester United is built as much on adversity as it is on its successes. And I can't remember when I first knew about the Busby Babes, but I remember Mum had photos of these men, and sometimes you forget that you see them as ghosts, I suppose, but these people, these individuals, and it's learning about who they were, the men they were, the fathers they were to become, the fathers they would have been, that I don't know, you just... even all these years on, even never seeing them, reading all that just makes you emotional. And it's never a competition. You pay your homage as you see fit. That's all. It's always personal. But listening to those words of Sir Matt, and after this, it's Tom about Duncan Edwards, and then Pete Martin paying tribute with one of his songs. But it's just about never forgetting. For the families, I know David Pegg's family, and they appreciate that we always pay tribute. So it's I always think it's important about always paying tribute, always paying respects, and always remembering as you see fit. And I wrote something a few years back which I think is still relevant, and if you don't mind, I'll read. With each year, as time marches relentlessly on, there are more of us at Old Trafford who weren't around to see the Babes play, and can only dare imagine the indescribable burden of events that must have left such deep scars on supporters and staff alike who witnessed those tragic events unfold back in Manchester, let alone those present at Ream Airport to witness such suffering and heartache. I can't imagine this modern United side being decimated in such a way. Of course I can't. We live in times where we are protected against death, have no real understanding or comprehension of wars, watching them on our TV news, protected from the real images with censorship and control. The thought of any of our team in their prime being torn apart just doesn't bear thinking about, so I don't think about it. But that it happened to a team of ours does bear thinking about, and often too. I know of the Babes, their history, their impact, and what happened before, during, and after February 1958, because I'm as passionate about the past as I am as the present of this club of ours. From an early age, I remember seeking as much United knowledge as I could. I may not win any quizzes or remember the words to many of the great United songs, but I've tried to educate myself as much as I can about our history, for ours it is, mine, yours, and yours to pass on. Glazers come and Glazers go, but we are here to stay. A chat with older Reds, sadly dismissed by many fans at games, is a fascinating experience because they have seen and lived through so much. Younger Reds, of course, don't have any blueprints to follow, and as with everything, each to their own as how you should support or go about learning any United way. Nobody should be force-fed. They don't want to know. And as I choose to seek out as much information as I can about our history, from record books to biographies and like, I can understand that for a lot of younger Reds, this doesn't appeal. All they may care about is the here and now, the present day and the present team. And one day, no doubt, as it ever was, they will have seen enough to have their own fascinating stories about decades of United's history and support to tell and pass on to one another and younger generations who come in our and their place. But when it comes to February the 6th, 1958, I do think that a basic level of understanding is something that every Red should go out of his way. And you don't really have to go that far to acquire it either, to understand. With ageing Reds sadly dwindling in number, it's left to those of us who don't experience the period to keep the memories of Duncan, Tommy and the rest alive. For a team died playing for the team we support, surely though no debt is ever asked, the least we owe them is to preserve their memories. I understand from seeing United internet forums, a curse or a blessing depending on which day you check, that there is an argument about how we should react to our tragedy so many years on. Each their own, of course, again, and people commemorate the anniversary in whatever way they see fit. But commemorate it they should, I do believe, however briefly. I don't think it's important if people want to sing The Flower of Manchester by the plaque or not, but as Greenoff J8 put it so well on the Red Issue Forum one day, every year on the 6th we remember it, each in their own way, for 10 seconds, a minute, or whatever. But as long as we remember, it doesn't matter how. Anyone the week in Manchester, the week Sir Matt died, or at the game, knows exactly how Manchester United and its supporters feel about their legends. The memory of that day will never leave me as long as I live, and I'm sure those around at the time of Munich feel the same. But it saddens me when passing the plaque on occasion to encounter a whole host of people wearing United colours and certainly not old enough to know better, who appear to know nothing about the plaque and what it represents, and whose ignorant questions and lack of understanding about the most simplest United memorials defies belief. How can they support a club and yet fail to integrate itself with its history? How can you not know about the Babes? It's not asking too much. Of course they could go from the forecourt and want to find out more, but with each passing year I find that more and more people arrive at Old Trafford, caring little for the past, wanting the theme park experience and wanting fuck all to do with the remainder of our culture, failing to realise that without our past there is nothing, for it builds and defines our future and binds us. We take the baton from our dads and mums and we cherish it and then pass it on to our kids. Those who just turn up blindly unaware of anything but Cristiano Ronaldo and Eric are here and now. I just stand for the success. And as we rightfully slag off Glazers for knowing nothing about the traditions of the club, we should also point the finger at those closer to home who will wear their shirts with pride on a match day but know nothing about those who wore it before them. I dare not imagine what it must have been like to have been a United fan during those terrible times in 1958. I can only imagine the horror to a parent of one of those who died, a wife, the lover, the brother, the children. And so it is that whatever I think of that era, my mind always turns to the survivors. There is always perhaps a greater tragedy in those that were left behind, forever haunted. If my picture my best mates and think how it must have been to see so many perish in front of your eyes, as much as there is an incredible story in the way that those survived fought for the club to continue through the tragedy and keep their mates' memories alive, and with the help of others 10 years later conquer Europe, it is impossible to imagine what effects this had on those that lived. Sir Matt, Harry Gregg, Bobby Charlton to name but three of the more well-known. There are many tragedies of that crash, and one is those who were left behind, I'm sure of it. I shudder at them over the years, seeing it thrown back at them as rival fans taunted us with Munich chants whilst they were present at games. How must the survivors have coped with that? What memories they must have brought back. And although Liverpool fans were as guilty as anyone of singing that sick song, I feel a great deal of sympathy to their fans who saw mates die at Hillsborough too. Again, I have no comprehension of the horrors of that day too. United fans who taunt that disaster should be ashamed of themselves. It's with that in mind, not that I clear him of being rude at times, that I always feel a great deal of sympathy when Bobby Charlton is accused of being such a surly man when encountered by United fans over the years. Maybe it's no excuse, but excuse him I do. Nobby Charles said of Charlton, "You never forget the horror." And Samat, years on, said, "The recollections bring so much grief. Although I do face it, I still wonder at times if the whole sorrowful business did really happen." The fact which must be faced, though, is the loss of many of my greatest footballers and my finest friends happened. Jimmy Murphy, a man who deserves much more accolades in our memories than he does, spoke 10 years on that the heartache of Munich is still there. To the grand generation which has grown up since then, they may just be names, but to me they were Matt's boys, my boys. When he flew to Munich to be with the players, he met Matt. The surgeons felt he might live, but no one except those of us close to him ever felt he would be a force again in football. But I knew. In one of his conscious moments, he whispered, "Keep the flag flying, Jimmy. Keep things going until I get back." At that moment, Matt didn't even know how many of his boys had been killed. I did. As I stumbled out of the hospital into the snow, which still lay thick as a carpet over the city of Munich, I was close to tears. Tom Williams, a Liverpool chairman, rang Jimmy Murphy and said, "Any of my star players we can give you to keep United afloat, let me know, and we will." Heavens knows how hard it must have been for Charlton. He said, "I just couldn't take it in, and therefore it washed over me. I didn't want to accept what happened. When I got home, it was worse. I could feel and smell the tragedy then. It was unbearable when I met people I had known through players that had died. We had not been playing football games in which one side lost and the other side won in the aftermath. We had to win those games. The alternative was to return to a melancholy of Manchester." Harry Gregg explained, "I had gathered that when Jimmy saw Matt Busby in hospital, the boss had told him things must go on." Jimmy Murphy explained, returning back to Manchester, "It was terrible at home. The papers were still full of the crash. I can't recall much about it, but then I don't think there is much to remember. The side wasn't being rebuilt. There wasn't enough time to do that. It was being repatched. The city was shocked. It was so, so sad. Fulks, Bill Fulks, described the aftermath. The remaining members of the team now went to Blackpool, to the Norbrick Hydra Hotel, where we started to do during the European Cup runs of the previous two seasons. We virtually lived there, and I do not remember seeing my wife more than one day a week for 6 weeks. We just had to get away. With all its shattering atmosphere of hysteria and grief, living together was essential to try and find some kind of team spirit, which we managed to do with such a strong, strange assortment of players. In fact, the team spirit became quite incredible as we made our unsteady way to the cup final. I remember we posed for a photograph of the playing staff soon after arriving in Blackpool, and what a weird picture we made. There were a few reserves who had played occasional games in the first team, but most of the rest looked like a gaggle of school kids. But how these lads fought. Jimmy Murphy talked to that first game against Sheffield Wednesday. I felt very sorry for the Sheffield side. They were never in the game with a chance, for I'm sure everyone who took an interest in football willed us to win that night. I could not believe that the skeleton that was leading out Manchester United was Bill Fulks. The crowd was hysterical and I was not far away from being in the same state. It's testament to Murphy and those around him that the club went on. To the players who survived the crash and willed themselves to keep the memory of their mates alive, it's nothing sort of miraculous that we carried on. Harold Hardman on the front cover of the Sheffield Wednesday programme wrote, "United will go on. The club has a duty to the public and a duty to football. We shall carry on even if it means that we are heavily defeated. Here is a tragedy which will sadden us for years to come, but in this we are not alone. An unprecedented blow to British football has touched the hearts of millions. Wherever football is played, United is mourned." So I'm hopefully trying to explain why it's still important for every one of us. I hope that if just one reading this, who knows little of that time by the basics, then decides to take time out to consider just what happened to our club that year and why it's so important now that so many of us remember every year, not just on the 5th, February the 6th. Remember a soon-to-be-married Duncan Edwards, a Roger Byrne who never discovered that his wife Joy was expecting a child, that Jeff Bent never saw his daughter Karen grow up, nor Mark Jones's son, with Eddie Coleman, David Pegg having all that and all their memories to come. Tommy Taylor also to wed, and Liam Whelan, whose last words to Harry Gregg were, "If the worst happens, I'm ready for death. I hope we all are." All of those that died had their futures, their glorious futures in front of them. We owe them their memories. I can't help but be emotional when I write this. You hear some people, some young of the younger generation, saying that because they weren't alive, it doesn't really affect them. But a team died who played for Manchester United. If that doesn't move, inspire and motivate you to educate yourselves in the Manchester United way and traditions, then you should find a clue. Duncan Edwards was the Babes' talisman, the man who awoke from his coma and recognised Murphy. "What time's kick-off against Wolves on Saturday?" he asked. 2:30 as usual," said Murphy. "Get stuck in, lads," were Edwards' last words. They say he was the greatest, so Matt explained why this wasn't the miss of time propelling him into undeserved greatness. I think about Duncan Edwards a lot. I sometimes fear there is a danger that people will think that we who knew him and saw him in action boost him because he is dead. Sentiment can throw a man's judgment out of perspective, yet is not the case with him. Whatever praise one likes to heap on Duncan Edwards is no more than he deserves. There was no other player in the world like him, and there's been nobody to equal him since. His gravestone reads, "A day of memory sad to recall. Without farewell, he left us all." And that's why I hope all Reds realise, young and old alike, that the Babes left us all. And it's up to us to never forget, however you see fit. Thank you for listening. And now I speak to Tom Clare a few months ago. So I'm with Tom Clare, a renowned United author who saw the Babes so many times. We've talked about this over a pint so many times, but just on how good Duncan was for you.
Duncan, when you look at his ability, his natural ability, and how consistent he was, I mean, you've only got to go back through his record as a youngster. He was playing county schoolboy football at 11 years of age. He was captain of the county at 12. He was in the England schoolboys team at 13 and played for 2 years and captained them. So, you know, that says something. But when he came to Old Trafford, his rise was so quickly. He didn't even play in the reserve team, you know. But his ability was, it was unbelievable.
What was his greatest asset? Was it with the ball or just
for a big guy? He was very, very quick, but he read the game. He had two great feet. He didn't know which was his best foot. He could read the game. He was power, he was grace, you know. But he could control a game. He could take a game by the scruff of the neck, you know.
Yeah,
he had bad games, but his consistency was unbelievable. And at that time, to be capped for England at just 18 years of age wasn't enough. And he got 19 caps, you know, and he was never ever dropped. But his appearance in the side, it lifted the side. You know, if you were struggling, you could rely on them to pull something out of the bag. I always remember some of the goals that I scored. And one was a six-round FA Cup tie against Everton in 1957. And Everton were a bit of a bogey side to the Babes. And he picked the ball up in the centre circle. There was no score getting towards the end of the game. And he started to drive forward. And they had a captain called Peter Farrell. A real good player, but as hard as nails. And he bounced off Duncan. And as the players come to play, he let fly from about 25 yards. The ball never got off the ground. And Dunlop, the keeper who'd had a great game, was in the back of the net. And we were through at the semi-final. But he did that in a lot of the games. The goal that they show on YouTube against Germany, who were world champions, you see what he did there. He won the ball, and then he just, his strength took him through. But he was no mug. He could look after himself, you know. I mean, everybody thinks of this gentle giant, you know, this fella who was big lad, but, you know, the boy next door, he was fucking hard, I'll tell you. He was as hard as nails, and nobody took liberties with him. And I always remember that Wolves had probably the dirtiest player I ever saw was a wing half called Eddie Clamp. And Billy Whelan, you know, the Irish lad, the inside right, he was a brilliant player, but physically he was frail, and he would allow people to bully him. And this fella, Clamp, started to get inside him. And then just after half-time against Wolves, there was a loose ball, and it was like a tank trap being laid. It was like a tank trap being laid, and all of a sudden Duncan appeared, and he hit the ball, he hit Clamp, and Clamp shot up in the air, and he come down and he busted two ribs, you know. Duncan had stood over him. Look at the 57 cup final when Matt Parlin look at the first player on the scene. It's the only time I ever saw him come close to losing it,
right,
you know, because he was over it. But he loved to play the game, you know. He'd play anywhere.
I know we've talked about it, you know, but I just find it, well, it's incomprehensible for any generation that you lost those players when they could have achieved everything.
As Sir Matt used to say, if they'd have lived, they'd have won the boat race. That's how good they were. You know, but they had a lot of strength in depth.
Yeah.
You know, I know what people forget, Barney. The accident happened. Jimmy got them to the cup final, you know.
Yeah.
The following season, we finished runners up in the league. People forget.
Yeah. Well, look, and Bobby Charlton scored 27 or 28 goals in that season.
It was as though he had the world on his shoulders, but some of the goals he scored, they were.
He must have, Tom. I mean, that must be how he. How
the problem with Duncan is that if it's not on video or it's not on DVD, people today say, oh, well, he can't have been that good. You know,
I saw it.
Talk to any people of my generation and look at all the records, all the accolades.
Yeah.
People like Finney, Matthews, you know, Billy Wright and everything. He was the greatest player at that time. You know, people say to me, he never achieved. He didn't reach it.
Yeah.
What I say to them, well, you've got to remember he played 180 games. when it was a 42-game season. So you got 4 years there at top class. He played at international. He played in World Cup qualifiers. He got two championship medals. He got an FA Cup winners medal. He got five Youth Cup winners medals. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's phenomenal what that lad did.
He's shaped your life as well, Tom. Yeah. You know, in terms of
the way he lived his life. You never saw him in the pub. You never saw him with a cigarette in his hand. He just lived any game. He'd play any game he could. He played one. There was one year where he played for the youth team in the morning, and I think they were away at Huddersfield, and he played for the first team in the afternoon. You wouldn't even see it today. And you've got to remember,
and I presume the pitches must have been, we've got the photo of George Best now, they must have been even worse than the
only,
you know,
they were only on a nodding acquaintance with grass during August. After that it was gone. But they were glue pots. But it's physical strength, you know. He was just so strong. He was infectious. His love for the game. He would go anywhere for a game of football. And that's the way it was. For me, the tragedy of it is, if he had a limb, I don't think he'd have been happy, because he'd have been in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
You know. And one of the saddest things for me was Munich this year. We was going to the hospital and actually seeing the hospital room where he was, and talking to the nurse who looked after him, you know. And she said the big lad with the kidney problem, she said, you know, said he would not live. You know, so I doubt he would have been able
this
to
is
live.
So
live,
sad.
You know, but the other side of it was, he was the one player that would have been able to unite everything. They could have built the team around him. Had he lived, they could have built the team around him.
It's just a travesty of life we got, you know, robbed of
that
of a team.
That team, people. It's sad because you can't show people. The only full game I know is the 57 Cup final, and that was ruined. You know, and they didn't perform.
Yeah, but you saw it with your own eyes. So we've got your memories. We've got,
you know, they. Well, to see these kids come through, I mean, with Duncan, you had him there, the powerhouse, but he was articulate, you know, he could hit a ball short, he could hit it long, he was deadly accurate with what he did, his heading ability was unbelievable. And then on the other side, you had the compliment of little Eddie Coleman, you know, this little sort of 5'8" wing guard who could thread a ball through a needle, who had this uncanny body swerve and what have you, and he complimented him
with the swift hips.
And in the middle, he had the big Yorkshire lad, Mark Jones, and he people again.
But there are, they're only names, you bring them to
the World Cup 1958.
Yeah,
Brazil won it with Pelé. Yeah, and a wonderful player called Didi. 18 months before, they played England at Wembley, and England beat them 4-2 and missed two penalties. And Duncan, Roger Byrne, and Tommy Taylor played in that game, and Taylor terrorised him. He scored twice in that game.
Well, how good was Taylor? Because I mean, the record
to me,
is
the
just
best centre forward I've seen.
Really,
better than Law. Yeah, but different in their own way. But the nearest to Tommy Taylor was Rude.
Right.
Rude could score goals from all over.
Right.
You know. But Tommy, he was the first sort of centre forward that would drag people out of the middle. He was the one that would go out to win. And he had a great understanding with Dennis Violet. And he would make the space for Violet. And if you have a look, 55-56, Whelan, Taylor, Violet, 93 goals between them.
Because Violet's,
when have you ever seen anything like that?
I know you've done much to promote Dennis Violet's record, because there's some who get forgotten, you know, the Alex Dawson afterwards coming in.
See, Alex was unfortunate. You know, the problem when after the accident, all the young kids who've done the part, the pressure began to tell them.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't realise that within 20 months of the accident, most of those young kids were no longer at the club. But Big Alec, if you have a look at his scoring record with United, he'd stand up with
everyone. Yeah.
And he was another one. He was a tank.
How does it feel? You've obviously seen the game today then, Tom. How does it... I know you've mentioned, you know, they all just live with you, you know, and resonate. How does it feel going to Old Trafford?
Well, Old Trafford today is totally different. You know, I mean, I look at players today that were out there that, with the babes, they wouldn't have got near it. I mean, I'm being honest.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not being sentimental. I'm being honest. I look at Lukaku, you look at Tommy Taylor. You know, you look at Mata, you look at Billy Whelan. Billy Whelan, now here's a guy.
Yeah.
Little Irish guy, but he wasn't little, he was 6 foot. Playing from midfield, 74 appearances, 43 goals. And that's what I'm saying. They, as a unit,
yeah,
they were such a good team.
But that's because they grew up together. Yeah,
they did, you know. But they had match winners.
Yeah.
They had match winners all of David Pegg. And if he wasn't on form, Scanlon was coming. Wilf McGuinness was Duncan's deputy. And what they used to do at times, if any Violet or Taylor were injured, they'd shut Duncan up front and bring Wilf in. At centre half, he had the rock that was Mark Jones.
Yeah.
But then if he had injuries, Jackie Branswell would come in.
What's your favourite memory? Is it the Bilbao game? Or?
Oh, without doubt. Yeah. The Bilbao game was unbelievable because that
the atmosphere that you've written about.
The atmosphere that night was the Barcelona game in 84 was terrific. But for me, that Bilbao game, it was the first time anybody had seen it, and it was that main road as well. And the atmosphere actually helped carry it. The Spaniards shit the same.
Well, you've written about, so I mean, you've catch tickets, not catch tickets, that's the wrong term, but you've written about it. You've queued up, but you've also sorted out the
priest.
Yeah, you've sorted out the priest tickets.
You know, that was always
revised back to Tom's old writings in the mag and that. But you've sorted that out. What, you're going into the ground. Yeah.
Well, I had a mate of mine called Brian Walsh. He lives in San Francisco now, and we used to go to games together. And that night, we went straight from school. School finished at 4:15, and where our school was where the old BBC studios used to be on Oxford Road. And we finished school, and we walked to Main Road.
Yeah.
Walked up Cambridge Street past the Dental Hospital. All the way up Lloyd Street to Main Road, and the atmosphere, you could feel it. Everybody, you know, could they do it? They had the score for it without them scoring. Could they do it, you know? And the ground comes sort of 6:45, the ground was locked, and then rolls and everything, and they just willed them to win. When I got home, we lived in Chalton on Medlock, and my father was sat on the front step, and he said they could hear the roars from there.
So you can still visualise.
Oh yeah, I can remember. I can remember what happened in 1956-57.
Yeah.
Don't ask me where McCarthy is at. You know, I can't. But there's so much of that era I can remember. But they were just infectious. If you look at the records, people forget United were the first English team in Europe. Yeah. They ignited the passion for European football.
Yeah.
And the way they were playing, that first year they won the title, they won it by 11 points, and that was the biggest margin from before the turn of the century. you know.
Yeah. Well, we are everything. We are everything to the base.
This young team, you know, everybody wanted to see it.
Yeah.
If you look back through the records of that time, all the home attendances of the clubs was against Manchester United.
Yeah.
The records were there.
Well, lovely, Tom.
You know, they were just such a draw, you know, and they really were. And the great thing is they'll never ever be forgotten.
Never.
You look at a lot of teams, you know, great teams, you get forgotten. Edwards is still probably the most talked about player going.
Yeah.
You can't pay him a higher compliment.
It's a pleasure, Tom, as ever. Thanks so much. Thank you.
You know, it's great.
One cold and bitter Thursday in Munich, Germany, 8 great football stars conceded victory. 8 men will never play again, who met destruction there. Oh, the pride of English football, the flowers of MacBusby's lads were flying home, returning from Belgrade. The great United family eaten masses of their trade. The pilot of the aircraft, the skipper, Captain Payne. 3 times he tried to take off, and twice again. And the third time down the runway, disaster followed close. Was ice upon the wings, and the aircraft never rose. It smashed into the marshy ground, it broke and overturned. An 8 of United's lads were killed as the battered aircraft burned. Roger Byrne and Tommy Taylor were capped for England's side. Ireland's Billy Whelan and England's Jeff Ben died. Mark Jones and Eddie Coleman and Dave also, before the blazing wreckage went a ploughing through the snow, a train, a coach, and a secretary, and a member of the crew. Also, 8 sporting journalists who were the United flew, and one them big Swifty we never will forget. The finest English goalkeeper who ever graced the nets. Say that Duncan Edwards died with injuries to the brain. They say that Jackie Blanchflower will never play again, and the great MacBusby lying there, the father of the team. 9 months or more will pass before he sees another game. Oh, England's finest football team, a record truly great. A proud success is mockened by a cruel twist of fate. 8 men will never play again, who met destruction there. Oh, the pride of English football, the flowers are